secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh, making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chased him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBTQ movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they're defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
International Workers' Day was celebrated in France with hundreds of marches nationwide as leftists of all sorts united to celebrate equality, solidarity, and worker empowerment.
The 1st of May is the International Day for workers to get together and discuss how to defend themselves. It's seemingly the only day where workers mobilise for their rights worldwide, and we see how there are so many countries represented here. Today is more important than any election or particular movement.
In 2020 and 2021, May Day was muted due to the coronavirus pandemic. The celebration is back to full strength this year, and many marchers have an added reason to be politically active. The recent re-election of Emmanuel Macron following a campaign dominated by the far right. Economic stagnation, record inflation, a bitter election campaign with results few are genuinely happy about. Many believe some changes are coming for France. The French left is in the middle of perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone, rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the Yellow Vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow-to-elbow with protesters at Yellow Vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major Yellow Vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
People in the Gaza Strip mark this year's Eid al-Fitr holiday for the 16th time under the Israeli blockade. The joyful occasion comes at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, Muslims go to markets several days before Eid to buy gifts, new clothes, and sweets for their loved ones, but many here can't afford that because of the high unemployment and poverty rates. United Nations figures show that 80% of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been relying on handouts in recent years in order to survive.
I'm having a very hard time while trying to buy new clothes for the holiday. I'm on a very tight budget, and I really don't know how to get through this holiday. There is hardly any money in Gaza, and the situation is only getting worse day after day.
For Gazan families, it has been a very tough task to buy Eid items for their children amid the harsh economic situation in the besieged coastal enclave. People scour the markets for hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
Most Gazans are broke and can't buy Eid items for their families. Gifts and clothes are very expensive, but we're determined to celebrate this holiday. The Israeli blockade and the last wars will not steal our joy.
For merchants, this Eid season has been one of the worst they had in years. Usually during holidays like Eid al-Fitr, sales are high in markets around the world. But in Gaza, shop owners complain of lack of sales.
This has been the most difficult economic condition in over a decade, and people lack the purchasing power. Most people come to the market just to look around, and they hardly buy anything because the economic situation here is very bad. Things are tough, but the spirit of Eid al-Fitr is here, and people will try to make the best of it.
Despite the harsh circumstances, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing themselves to receive Eid al-Fitr holiday like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the US and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukrainian conflict, it has not subsided in any shape or form. The situation is becoming more dire and dangerous. More dangerous since the way Russia sees it, the West's excessive push to arm Ukraine is fueling the conflict, possibly edging closer to a World War III scenario. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is so keen to focus only on arming Ukraine and defeating Russia, but not on ending the war and saving lives.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S., joins us from New York. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Marcus Papadopoulos, I'll start with you. Looking at the most recent development that is of significance is what happened on the ground with the Russian strikes that hit a U.S. weapons, depot at an airfield near Odessa. The Russian Defense Ministry said that this was a military airfield, and it destroyed a runway and a hangar containing the Western-supplied weapons and ammunition. To me, that sounds like progress on the Russian side.
Well, the response of the West to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine is not only about trying to deprive Russia of Ukraine, but it is also centered on the Western ruling elites attempting to preserve the global order which they established some 30 years ago following the demise of Soviet communism and the dissolution of the USSR. So on the one hand, by the West flooding Ukraine with all sorts of weaponry, the Western ruling elites are hoping to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army, which I should say is both fanciful and also exceedingly dangerous for global peace and global stability. And on the other hand, the Western ruling elites are trying now to preserve
the global order, which has been in existence for three decades now, because the Western ruling elites, specifically Washington and London, are acutely aware that because of their stance on Russia, because of the sanctions they have imposed on Russia, Beijing and Moscow have become even closer. Uh-huh. And it is abundantly clear that Russia and China are now intent on dismantling the global order which the West created 30 years ago. And as regards the military situation in Ukraine, well, the Ukrainian armed forces are virtually paralyzed as a result of potent Russian military strikes on them. Furthermore, the Russians are now systematically destroying the logistics chain of the Ukrainian armed forces, which means the Ukrainian armed forces in eastern Ukraine and in southern Ukraine will not be able to be replenished with soldiers and weaponry.
Okay. Ian Williams, it doesn't sound like you agreed with anything our guests there said from London.
It's like Alice in Wonderland, everything through a looking glass. First of all, may I wish you a happy May Day, comrades all over the world. And just to get over the binary politics, I should remind you that May Day started in Chicago. It was an American holiday. It's celebrated all the world over, usually by workers parading, not by military oligarchs and dictators parading their troops in the Kremlin or Red Square or anywhere else. So having got that ritual greeting out of the way, I'd point out, who are the biggest importers of weapons into Ukraine? The Russian army brought billions of dollars worth of high technology weapons into Ukraine. No one asked them to. They brought them for free. They've been told to take them out. Oh, they want negotiations. Anytime they want peace, all they have to do is to obey international law, obey the strictures of the International Court of Justice, listen to what the rest of the world is saying, and get their troops out of there. That's all they need for peace. That's all you need. So when a bully punches someone in the face and friends come and aid the victim, this is aggression. This is aggression. Let's get the perspective. It is Russian weapons, which the Ukrainians are using mostly, by the way. Most of the Ukrainian weapons supply is ex-Soviet or Russian that they bought recently from Russia. The Russian weapons is drying up. The rosy military situation that Comrade Papadopoulos talked about is not nearly as rosy. They stopped making the weapons because they relied on imported Western components, because Putin had concentrated so much on military hardware and turning the place into a failed third world petrostate, he neglected the industry. Now, he was aided in this with Western neoliberal economists who really trashed his economy for it. But he and his oligarchs were willing accomplices on this, as long as they got the money and took enough for the army. So, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around here. But the essence of it is international law, as Guterres said, the Guterres who went on a peacemaking mission, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the Russians shelled and bombed the city that he was visiting. How is that for a gesture of peace? How is that for a gesture of good intentions? These are not equivalents. We have a brutal, rapacious dictator who has invaded another country.
Sure, let's get back
to another country with loads of weapons and is not destroying logistics. He's destroying cities. He's destroying apartment blocks.
Marcus,
he's blowing up hospitals.
Let's get Marcus's response here.
This is not countenanceable by any civilized measure.
The diverging views, Marcus Papadopoulos, is very evident, because I think the U.S. is calling it diabolical when they describe Putin in some sense. And I use that because Nancy Pelosi, the U.S. House Speaker, visited Ukraine very recently. I mean, first of all, why would she visit Ukraine? I mean, I think she could have done a Skype with Zelensky to show her support, but she had to somehow make sure that she was present there. Why do you think that was? The only reason I could think of here is that she wanted to make sure that, aside from, I guess, sympathize with him and show solidarity, to make sure that Zelensky actually is continuing the war. I mean, what other reasons would she have?
Well, I think there are a number of factors, one of them being that politicians in, for example, America, sense an opportunity to make a name for themselves. We have to remember that the caliber of politicians in the United States is atrociously low. So people such as Pelosi are hoping to enter the textbooks of history as being the ones who played a vital role in the defeat of the Russian army and in the subsequent downfall of Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, the Americans understand in private that the Russians are winning the war in Ukraine. They understand that the Ukraine, which existed prior to the 24th of February 2022, will never, ever return. They understand that a new and enlarged Russian state is in the making. So by visiting Kiev, Pelosi and other American politicians are attempting to bolster the morale of the Ukrainian ruling elite and of the Ukrainian armed forces, together with the morale of Ukrainian paramilitaries, at what is a perilous time for them. And as regards to the origins of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine, we have to be mindful that for 30 years, beginning in 1992, following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Moscow asked, told, warned America not to extend its tentacles to Ukraine, because Ukraine is of vital importance to Russian national security and is absolutely imperative to the Russian national identity. If Russia was to extend its tentacles to Canada and Mexico, I would thoroughly condemn that. Why? Because it would be dangerous for global peace and global security.
Sure. Ian Williams, would you like to respond?
This concept has been used by other people. The last person to use it called it Lebensraum. He said the Germans had a destiny to take over their neighbors. This is what we have here. We have Russisch Lebensraum. We have the Russians saying that they have a manifest destiny. This is a bit like Britain saying, we owned Ireland for 800 years. It's ours, really. We go back in and get it any time. This type of atavistic empire building from the Slavic swamps. Remember, the Russian state was actually born in Ukraine. If anything, the Ukrainians should be taking over Moscow, which was a Mongol-ruled swamp when Russia, when the Rus was a pinnacle of civilization on the steppes there. This is atavistic, proves nothing at all. This is an evocation of history to promote Lebensraum. It's a bit like the Zionist claim to Israel. Our ancestors may have been there 3,000 years ago, so we can go and take it now and heaven help the people who are in it. It's got no relation. Now, on the case of Pelosi, I haven't got much time for Pelosi or American politicians, but I will say Pelosi and Biden and Angelina Jolie have actually gone into war zones to show their support. Vladimir Putin would only meet the Secretary General of the United Nations across a table the length of a football pitch because he's so scared that someone is going to poison him. And why is he so scared they're going to poison him? Because his laboratories, his FSB and his people are providing the wherewithal to do so and have done so to the opposition at home and abroad. This is, you know, we're in, once again, an Alice in Wonderland world.
All right.
No time for Pelosi and the general principles, but I admire her.
Before you jump in, Marcus Papadopoulos and Ian Williams, both of you, I'd like to first thank for not interrupting each other while you were speaking, though you both disagree. But I'd like to ask both, if you'd like, you can jump in so we can make this more lively. And I say that because, in essence, we're running out of time. So, Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead. But, of course, let's try to do it so that we can understand what each other is saying. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. I abhor all forms of racism. And what I heard just now from the guest in New York was racism towards Russians. Referring to Russia as a swamp is absolutely disgusting. I would also like to say this as well. Would you not interrupt me? Democracy is partly about respecting other people's opinions and allowing other people to speak. Now, In regard to the significance of Ukraine to Russia, if the gentleman in New York is so very au fait with the history of both Russia and Ukraine, then perhaps he can explain to me and to our audience the significance of 1654, the Treaty of Pereyaslav, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky. I suspect he will have great difficulties in being able to do that. The truth of the matter is that with the exception of the westernmost parts of Ukraine,
right,
namely Ternopil, Lvov, Ivano-Frankivsk, Rivne, and Volyn, the rest of Ukraine is directly linked to Russia and the Russian people. They are the same people. Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians are East Slavs. Much of the Ukrainian population are members of the Moscow Patriarchate. Again, you are interrupting me. You are not being respectful. I have responded to what you said, and now I will give way to you. That is partly what democracy is about.
Ian Williams, go ahead.
Excuse me, I've got... The moderator said we should cut in with each other. I am very sorry, Margot, on this, but I kept my quiet. But when you come out with absolute rubbish, I do have to contradict and get in there.
Well,
what
that's...
What have you done for Russia?
I got to jump in here. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. When you say that, that's kind of what Lloyd Austin said. And many are critiquing him for saying that, in a sense, because it kind of parallels what you said, in which he said the U.S. goal in this war is to weaken Russia over the long term. And some are saying that, well, the U.S. then lied, because that's not what it said in the beginning. In the beginning, it wanted to end what it called an insurgency that was going on. And then it went on to say there should be some peace efforts to happen. But now it has come out and said, no, our aim is to weaken Russia.
It's the U.S. that's weakened Russia. It's Putin.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos. Let me ask Marcus to jump in. Marcus Papadopoulos.
Putin managed to rip up the guarantees.
You had the U.S. Secretary of Defense, as they call it, Lloyd Austin, in that after the meeting that happened in Germany, where U.S. invited 40 countries, it said something that was very, in some ways, eye-opening, promising to move heaven and earth to ensure Ukraine's victory in the war. Now, we know that Secretary Lloyd Austin was immediately, after retiring from CENTCOM, to have joined the board of Raytheon Technologies. But aside from that...
Whose shares have dropped, by the way, because they were selling to Russia, and those sales have been stopped by the sanctions.
How is that for capitalism? What does that show when you have the U.S. Secretary of, as they call it, defense, make a statement like that, which squarely falls to a military solution, which goes hand-in-hand with the U.S. goal to weaken Russia?
And Putin isn't threatening, first of all...
That's Marcus Papadopoulos. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the Soviet economy, which by the time of the dissolution of the USSR was the second largest in the world, was actually destroyed by the pro-Western agenda of Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin. It had nothing to do with Vladimir Putin. I would also add that the gentleman in New York's knowledge of Soviet history and Russian history is not just lamentable, but it is also laughable. Now, turning to the American Defense Secretary's remarks, the Americans are attempting to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army with the knowledge that if Russia was to lose in Ukraine, and if Ukraine was to remain in the West sphere of influence and one day join NATO, then Russia could never hope to be the superpower that it was in Soviet times. Ukraine is absolutely imperative to Russia, not just in terms of Russian national security, but also in terms of Russian global power as a whole. So the Americans
want the jewel of the crown of the British Empire, so the British should go and get it back on the same budget
to try and defeat the Russian military.
So now I got to jump in now and give because we're almost out of time. Ian Williams, 30 seconds to you. I'm sorry, Marcus. Ian Williams, 30 seconds. are we looking at this conflict to have gone global? Marcus, go ahead.
Let me say, the Americans are also making a radical climb down by supplying the Saudi Arabian military with so much weaponry that the Saudis have killed some 200,000 Yemeni men, women, and children. The Americans do not care.
No time for the Yemenis. Why do you get Saudis?
The Americans do not care about humanity.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. We are out of time. I'm sorry about that. We're fresh out of time. Thank you. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Author, historian, political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavli, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Sues Hillary Clinton, Alleging Plot to Rig 2016 Election Against Him. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has sued Hillary Clinton, the Democratic National Committee, and other people and entities tied to the investigation of Russian election interference in 2016, claiming that, in a bid to rig the election, they orchestrated a conspiracy which made Watergate pale in comparison. The lawsuit came a day after the release of a letter from a prosecutor in New York, who said he believed Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felony violations in his business affairs, despite the district attorney in Manhattan choosing not to indict him. Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton for the presidency in 2016. Nevertheless, 6 years on, he alleges she is guilty of racketeering and a conspiracy to commit injurious falsehood, among other claims. The 108-page lawsuit follows lawsuits filed by Trump and allies in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, charging Joe Biden's victory was the result of electoral fraud. Out of 62 such lawsuits, only one succeeded. Among those also listed as defendants in the new lawsuit are ex-FBI officials James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Sturzok, and Lisa Page. The former British spy Christopher Steele, author of a famous dossier on Donald Trump's links to Moscow. Also, Jake Sullivan, now National Security Advisor to Joe Biden. And John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Florida by lawyers from the state and Alina Haber, a New Jersey attorney who represented Trump in failed lawsuits seeking to block investigation of the deadly Capitol riot on 6th of January 2021, which Donald Trump fueled with lies about electoral fraud. Those lawsuits have widely been seen as delaying tactics, meant to help Trump wait out the 6th of January committee until Republicans can retake the House of Representatives this November and kill the investigation. According to the Daily Beast, other attorneys for Donald Trump have complained about Haber's work. Russia denies interfering in the 2016 U.S. election to boost Donald Trump. The U.S. intelligence community claims that Russia did interfere. Robert Mueller, the special counsel who investigated the matter, did not establish collusion between Trump and Russia, but did list 10 instances in which the then president, Donald Trump, may have tried to obstruct justice. Robert Mueller, who explicitly said he was not exonerating Trump, also claimed several connections between Trump aides and Moscow. In August of 2020, a Senate Intelligence Committee report detailed links between Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager for part of the 2016 presidential race, and Russian intelligence operatives. Paul Manafort was jailed on charges of fraud. Donald Trump pardoned him. Regardless, Trump's new lawsuit claims that in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton and her cohorts orchestrated an unthinkable plot, one that shocks the conscience and is an affront to the nation's democracy. The lawsuit alleges, acting in concert, the defendants maliciously conspired to weave a false narrative that their Republican opponent, Donald J. Trump, was colluding with a foreign country. The lawsuit claims the conspiracy involved falsifying evidence, deceiving law enforcement, and exploiting access to highly sensitive data sources in a plot so outrageous, so subversive and incendiary that even the events of Watergate pale in comparison. It claims Hillary Clinton and her fellow defendants nefariously sought to sway the public's trust and work together with a single self-serving purpose to vilify Donald J. Trump. According to the lawsuit, the deception, malice, and treachery perpetrated by the defendants has caused significant harm to the American people and to the plaintiff Donald J. Trump, and they must be held accountable for their heinous acts. The lawsuit seeks punitive damages, costs and such further, and other relief as this court may deem just and proper. It says Trump has sustained significant injuries and damages, including but not limited to expenses in the form of defense costs, legal fees, and related expenses incurred in an amount no less than $24 million and continuing to accrue, as well as the loss of existing and future business opportunities. Eddie Honig, a former federal prosecutor, now an analyst for CNN, says, "It's difficult to put into words just how deeply flawed and utterly hopeless this lawsuit is." Philip Raines, a former Clinton spokesperson named in the lawsuit, pointed to how damaging an actual trial could be for Donald Trump when he tweeted, "I look forward to deposing the plaintiff." A lawyer for Peter Sturzok, the FBI agent who was fired for sending messages critical of Donald Trump, told the Politico website, "We haven't had a chance to read the complaint, but knowing the former president, there's probably very little in there that's true." Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment of Donald J. Trump. Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, two top prosecutors on the Manhattan district attorney's criminal investigation of Trump, resigned abruptly last month amid reports that the investigation into the former president's finances was foundering. The newly elected district attorney, Alvin Bragg, was reportedly more skeptical than his predecessor that the evidence his office's attorneys had gathered against Trump would be enough to convict him. In a February resignation letter obtained by the New York Times, Pomerantz wrote that the team of lawyers investigating Donald Trump had no doubt he had committed crimes, and that Alvin Bragg's decision not to move ahead with prosecuting Trump will doom any future prospects that Trump will be prosecuted for the criminal conduct we have been investigating. Mark Pomerantz reportedly wrote, "His financial statements were false, and he has a long history of fabricating information relating to his personal finances and lying about his assets to banks, the national media, counterparties, and many others, including the American people." The clock is ticking on the case against Donald Trump as the current term of the grand jury, which has been hearing evidence, expires in April. Ronald Fischetti, an attorney for Donald Trump, told The Guardian that the resignation letter simply reflected the prosecuting team's failure to make a convincing legal case against the former president, describing his client's innocence. Ronald Fischetti said, "Mark Pomerantz had several occasions to meet with Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, and his senior staff to lay out exactly what he intended to present to the grand jury in order to get an indictment, and he failed. He was unable to convince the district attorney and his senior staff that he had sufficient evidence to warrant an indictment." Ronald Fischetti said, "Alvin Bragg should be commended for not doing this on the basis of politics and just doing it on the basis of law, which he's supposed to do." While the resignation letter conceded that the case against Donald Trump could be challenging and that there were risks of bringing it to court, it argued that there was a strong public interest in prosecuting Donald Trump, even if a conviction is not certain. Mark Pomerantz reportedly wrote that former Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, who had been deeply involved in the case, had directed the team to present evidence to a grand jury and to seek an indictment of Donald Trump and other defendants as soon as reasonably possible. But Alvin Bragg, who was sworn in this January, reviewed the case and did not agree. Mark Pomerantz believed Bragg's decision not to seek an indictment of Trump was made in good faith, but also misguided and completely contrary to the public interest. Mark Pomerantz did not respond to a request for comment. Danielle Filson, a spokesperson for the district attorney, wrote in an email, "The investigation continues. A team of experienced prosecutors is working every day to follow the facts and the law. There is nothing we can or should say at this juncture about an ongoing investigation." A spokesperson for the Trump Organization called Mark Pomerantz a never-Trumper in a statement to the New York Times. Some in the Republican Party leadership reportedly feared Donald Trump's grip on the party and fixation on Hillary Clinton, 2016, and supposed electoral fraud could cost the GOP dearly in elections this year and in 2024. In legal jeopardy over his business affairs and attempted political subversion, Donald Trump has all but declared he will run for the White House again. Speaking to reporters in Brussels, Belgium recently, President Biden said of the 2024 presidential election, "I'd be very fortunate if I had the same man running against me."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.